What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. In this episode, we're talking to SHP's most voted influential speaker, Louise Taggart. She has got a harrowing story about her wee brother, and we're going to discuss that. We're going to cover briefly the story, and we're just going to discuss the things that businesses can do or should be doing and things going on in the industry to stop something like that ever happening again. Let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. What's up, guys? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to challenge the perceptions, to challenge the health and safety gone mad culture, but to also provide you with solutions and in-depth conversation via YouTube and podcasts to help you run your business, save lives and save money at the same time. Today we're talking to Louise Taggart. Louise Taggart is SHP's most influential speaker, and Louise has got a harrowing story about her wee brother. Her brother Michael passed away in an electrical incident, causing an obviously a fatality. When you really listen to this story, and you can go check out the full story on Louise's website, which we'll link in the description, and you can watch Louise's story, you can watch the videos, My Wee Brother, etc. Louise also travels around the country, so if you get yourself to any expos or something that Louise has had, I would definitely advise it. But have a listen with an open mind and think, you know, in my business, could something like this happen? Am I applying those pressures? Am I buying tools that aren't ergonomically right for my staff, forcing them to bypass inherent safety systems? Because the only way that we make real change is through us, the people. The only way that we really stop things like this happening is by employees demanding more and employers doing better. Sitting around waiting for legislation change, sitting around waiting for the government will take too long. It's on us to make this change. Let's get into the podcast.
Okay. Louise, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming on.
Hi, James. Glad to be on. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, thank you for coming along. I remember going to, it was actually the Health and Safety Expo when I first saw you speak. It was, I think it was on one of the smaller stands, but it was quite busy. And yeah, so it's just a phenomenal story. And it's, yeah, I definitely didn't have a tear in public. I would never admit to that. But it is amazing. So I suppose maybe let's just start there. Do you just want to kind of tell us your story and Michael's story and just kind of and go from there? Because it's really hard hitting, I think, and it's good for everyone to hear it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, well, as you say, it's my wee brother's story, really. And he was Michael Adamson, a 26-year-old electrician. He'd left the house that he shared with his fiancée on the morning of the 4th of August, 2005, back in 2005, and was expecting to get home that night to meet the puppy that his fiancée had picked up during the day that day. But he got a call sort of midway through the day from his employer asking him to go to an all-hands-on-deck job up in Dundee to get a JJB sports store and gym complex ready for a handover to their client by 10 o'clock the next again morning, or else some penalty clauses were going to kick in. Yeah. So, well, I mean, if you're saving for a wedding and you've been offered overtime probably right through the night, then of course he was going to go. Yeah. And yeah, it was sort of after 7 o'clock-ish anyway, when I get a call from my mum to say that her and my dad were on their way to the hospital in Dundee because Michael had been in an accident. And I'll admit, I didn't even think to ask what kind of accident. I just had in my head he'd been in a car accident. Mm-hmm. And yeah, when they say that, you know, they don't know how he is, you know that you just need to get yourself there. Yeah. So that's what we did. And yeah, when we got to the hospital in Dundee, it turned out that he was already dead. He'd suffered a fatal electric shock on that all hands on deck job that he'd been called to. So yeah, I mean, I vividly remember the car journey to that hospital, but I don't remember at all the car journey home. So yeah, we didn't really find out what happened to Michael until almost 3.5 years later. Which is when the court case happened. So we kind of, the HSE reported fairly quickly. So we knew bits of what might have happened, but we didn't get the full picture until, 3.5 years on. And so at the trial, we find out that he's not been given lock-off devices. The practice on the site was to use insulating tape over circuit breakers. So that's despite the fact these lock-off devices were in the employer's method statement. They hadn't been given a voltage tester with a proven unit, which again was in the employer's RAMS. We still don't know to this day what actually happened. So what Michael was doing was he had cut a cable that was labelled not in use.
Yeah.
They were to connect that cable to one that him and his colleague had pulled in themselves. But he cuts this cable that's labelled not in use. He throws it down and he then strips the insulating material from that cable. And it was when he got to the live wire that it was energised to mains voltage of 230 volts. So, you know, the HSE inspectors say if he'd been holding his snips by the insulated grips, there'd have been no effect there. But during the trial, we heard evidence from a number of other sparks to say, look, see, when we're doing that job, we've got our thumb on the metal part of the snips to get the purchase necessary to get that insulating material off. So we think that's what Michael was doing. And he was surrounded by metalwork. He's got the frame of that false ceiling that he's up through. He's standing on a set of steps that weren't fiberglass. He is holding those snips so he suffered a fatal electric shock as a result of that. As I say, we don't know the kind of process that Michael followed in the lead up to doing that. We don't know what he did in the lead up to all of that. We don't know if he tested or if he relied on that not in use label, or if he's tested when the circuit breaker was turned off, but because it's not safely isolated, someone's turned it on while he's working on it, or because he only had the multimeter available to him. He could have had that set to this wrong selection, which would give him a false zero reading. So all of those things, we don't know and we're never going to know the precise circumstances. But what we do know is that he wasn't given the right kit that he should have had in order to do that job safely. He was not set to work in a safe environment. He was not given the appropriate supervision and management that he should have been entitled to on that site. And it's all of those things that have accumulated and have taken his life.
It's a story that's really hard to listen to. And I think you get the sense that even now it's quite hard for you to tell, obviously, but I find it so hard to kind of listen to it because of the simple things that could have been there that were actually really, really easy to kind of manage. You know, lockout, tagout is something that is very common, you know, been around for a long time.
Oh, but yeah.
it is, frankly, it's something that, like, you know, I rarely see. And I've had contractors come in and we talk about, you know, how are you going to lock out, tag out? And we, when I worked in manufacturing, we had a lockout, tag out for many sources. Like, if you had something being like for gravity, you know, you could have a piece of machine and you would kind of lock it up if you're going to work underneath it. So it's got so much kind of, it's a real simple system to deal with so many hazards, is what I'm saying, or risks.
Yep.
But it seems really unknown to a point, like maybe not within the safety industry, maybe all of us, like people like myself that know about it, but what about the people actually doing the jobs? I find that it's not out there enough. Would you agree or disagree? Or
I think it's much better in the industrial arena than it is in the domestic arena, for example. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, Lotto had been taught to apprentices for 20 years prior to Michael dying.
Wow.
And yet it wasn't being implemented by the electrical contracting industry. Mm. The HSE inspector, who was the specialist electrical inspector from the HSE, he was going into major wholesalers asking for examples of Lotto devices so that he could produce them as evidence at the trial. So he's doing that in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
You know, not a small town.
No.
Major capital city. He's doing that here. And at every turn he was being told, nah, mate, don't stop them. No demand from industry for them.
No way.
A process that had been taught to apprentices for 20 years.
That blows my mind.
Yeah, and I've just recently sort of had a bit of engagement from somebody who was employed by my brother's employer at the same time as him, who basically used the excuse to me that, well, at that time, nobody else was doing it, so why should we have to do it? It's not bloody good enough.
Mm.
Absolutely, it's not bloody good enough.
That is that statement, though, is so it is wrong. And you know, for you to hear that must have been so frustrating. But it is synonymous of kind of what we see. Is that kind of, I've said for a long time, like the environment that we're in kind of defines our behaviours, and I said it time and time again in this podcast. But your brother would have stuck out like a sore thumb, probably, and maybe have been the slower electrician compared to somebody who's not doing Lotto because he's doing it right. Yeah. And that forces your brother to then be in a very awkward position. And everyone's like, well, we're not going to send Michael to that job because he does everything bloody right. He's a job's worth and he takes much longer. And that's the real horrible thing about this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was speaking to somebody. I got invited to the Electrical Industry Awards last week by Super Rod, who had done a piece of work which has been great. They've kind of a piece of work around safe isolation. So they did a bit of a sort of Facebook community survey of electricians, and we've sort of tried to get Michael's story out there to the electrical trade magazines.
Mm-hmm.
But what we were saying is, you know, all of this is all well and good, but yeah, if you've got your apprentices and you're teaching them the right thing to do and the right way to do it, as soon as they get out on site, they're getting the older hands saying to them, oh, come on, mate. Aye, right. Like, as if we're going to be doing it that way. Mm-hmm. Then those apprentices are going to get dragged back down to a level that they shouldn't be at. So we need to teach the apprentices the softer skills around the negotiation and about saying, you know, what's the right way to kind of stand up to your more experienced colleagues if they're trying to get you to do it the wrong way.
That's a great, yeah, that I was, as you were saying that, I was thinking, oh, we maybe need to target the older boys and just kind of, but actually what you're saying there is about focusing on the apprentices' soft skills. That's a great idea. That's phenomenal, actually. I would have never thought of that. What a great idea.
Yeah.
To just kind of enable them to be able to influence, maybe subtly, instead of having that awkward, no, I'm going to do it. And then, because eventually you get beaten down and you would eventually not do it. That's an amazing idea.
Yeah, I mean, we also do obviously have to target the older ones. But yeah, if we can bring that sort of new generation through who just know that it's the right thing to do and they're going to damn well do it, then hopefully we knock out that sort of complacency further up the tree.
it's fascinating because when I think back to just coincidentally, when I was in college, I did I wanted to be a lighting engineer in theatre. So you had to train to be an electrician first. So I went and did my first year at college, which was all in college and so not on the job, trained to be an electrician. So the first half of back when I did it, it was the first half in college and then the second half on the job. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my second half coincided with the what's it called? I nearly said revolution. It's not revolution.
Recession.
We got no money. Nobody's employing. Recession. And you think, you know, trying to get an apprenticeship in a recession just didn't happen.
Okay.
But when I think back to it, I think, do you know what? I can't ever remember talking about lockout tagout in college. Now I might have, but okay. Never when I started working in health and safety, if I'd have been taught it the second I read that first document about Lotto, I'd have gone, ah, I remember this, but I never had that. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think, in college, did we even touch on it?
Yeah, well, what's happened, so just actually from this sort of college year, SECT in Scotland, so the apprentice body in Scotland, they are including a sort of little video that I've produced, actually Siemens produced with me. They're going to include that in their Lotto, their sort of safe isolation module. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, they're going to sort of show that to apprentices at the start of each year, so that it kind of, yeah, that drip feed is there,
yeah,
and
it
sinks in with them. So yeah, they definitely are covering it up here. But yeah, I don't know to what extent practices vary across England, for example, or Wales. Yeah.
And simple things like that. I remember when I first heard your story, that the thumb over on the kind of outside of the insulated grips.
Yeah.
So like those that don't know, I think if I remember rightly, you probably correct me if I'm wrong, but most it grips are insulated to like 1,000 volts or something crazy like that.
Mm.
So way above what you in domestic especially would be working on.
Yeah.
But if you put your thumb on the end, it's completely pointless. And
yeah.
How do we deal with something like that? I mean, maybe it's exactly the same way. It's that kind of drip feeding. But is it, is it education that, you know, actually putting your thumb there, do you realize what you're doing? But then, you know, electricians know that, don't they?
Yeah, surely? Do you know, that's a sort of risk or hazard or whatever that really it should be designed out. Like, there should be a way of designing that out.
Mm.
The insulated grips go up so far, why don't they go over and cover the other bit?
Yeah, there's obviously a need for the electricians to put their thumb there. So instead of addressing them not putting their thumb there, let's make the tool work for them.
Yeah, let's design it out, yeah.
And I'm not aware of any work around that actually happening. Is that something that people are interested in, the industry manufacturers are interested in, making it a bit more ergonomically?
It's not something that I've heard about happening.
No.
Might be going on somewhere in the background that I just don't know about. But
fingers crossed, hopefully. So that kind of point, so obviously the Michael passed away, and then you kind of took it upon yourself then as the through the trial and onwards and what you're doing now, and you know, voted as you were SHP's most influential speaker and all that, you know, doing an amazing job. What kind of led you to doing that? Well, it's obvious what led you to do it, that, you know, but how did that kind of growth come about? Was it natural, or was it just this kind of emotional drive? Or
I think when Michael died, I was an employment lawyer.
Mm.
I'd been an employment lawyer for many moons, and if I'm being honest, I was a bit lost after he died as to what we needed to do, how we could make things better. We spent so long waiting on the trial to happen that it seemed that we spent the early sort of weeks and months battling with the Procurator Fiscal Service to find mm-hmm. out what was happening, like how were things progressing.
Yeah.
And it was about a year after Michael died that I found out about Families Against Corporate Killers. So a name that's designed to make folk sit up and take some notice. Mm. It's FAC for short. But this was a group of families who had also lost loved ones in work-related incidents, who had come together with Hilda Palmer from the Greater Manchester Hazard Centre, who had worked in the sort of safety arena supporting families for very many years beforehand. And these families had come together to be a source of support to one another, but also to campaign to try to make things better, to try and get lessons learned so that other families didn't have to go through what they were going through. Mm. And so I found out about them, and I joined up. I joined up. So that really has guided me ever since. It's from them that I've drawn the strength that I've needed to do what I now do. So in the early days, I would speak at conferences. And I mean, at school and university, I wouldn't have stood up in front of a room full of people like my classmates. I wouldn't have stood up in front of my classmates and spoken. Yeah. Absolutely shit scared of public speaking. And it was speaking at Michael's funeral that cured me of any fear of doing that. So I would go to conferences and I would speak about the families, but I would speak about the other families because I couldn't speak about what happened to Michael.
Oh, wow. Okay.
As soon as I did, I was away, floods of tears. So it was a call from Babcock International Group at Rosyth Dockyard that's led me to now telling Michael's story as it is these days. So it was somebody from the STUC had gone into Rosyth. They'd had a run of electrical incidents. Ian from the STUC had said to them, you should get Louise in to speak to them. And I went, no, you're kidding me on, like, I'm not doing that. Yeah. But actually, once you process it and you think to yourself, right, look, as an employment lawyer, I was a professional support lawyer. I was writing the training materials. I was delivering training to clients. So I've now sat with 4 weeks worth of trial notes from the criminal trial of my brother's employer, doing bog all, gathering dust on a shelf. Why don't I see if I can put them into some sort of presentation and go in and we'll do it, because it's a one-off. They've asked me in as a one-off. So I went in to do it as that one-off and then got asked to come back and speak to everybody on that site.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of grown from there, yeah, if I'm being honest. Mm. Yeah.
My old boss used to say, you do something once, you do it 1,000 times.
Yeah. So
make sure you know you want to do it 1,000 times.
Yeah, I definitely didn't. After that first time, there was no way I was doing it again. Yeah, but then you see the impact that it has.
Mm.
And you know then that positives are coming from something so crap.
Mm.
If we can, what I say is, you know, if we can leave him the living legacy that he didn't get to leave himself.
So true, isn't it? It's such a shame that we need, you know, we call it, especially in the fire game and stuff like that, you call it like stable door legislation, because, you know, we have a look at it once the horse has already bolted, and it's such a shame that we have to have that. But it does make people's ears prick up, doesn't it? It does make people listen when you get, you know, this kind of, yeah, well, I couldn't stop listening to you when I first, you know, heard your story. I was absolutely steely-eyed, and it is because you tell it really well, but it's an emotional kind of story, isn't it? It really hits you.
Yeah.
Such a shame that we have to have that to help everyone else. But, you know, I think you having that kind of most influential speaker title now, I think that says it all, really. You know, what you're doing is phenomenal. And I'm kind of talking like it's the end of the podcast. It's not, but I do think it's worth saying that, you know, I'm a firm believer that kind of change happens one by one, kind of like a virus. You know, you'll infect me with the change, and then I'll infect somebody else, and that will spread eventually. And whether that starts at Scotland and works its way down, then so be it. Let's just keep going with that. And it's a phenomenal job you're doing, and it must be horrendously hard, but thank you. I think you're doing an amazing job.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it can be pretty exhausting, but as I say, I know it has that positive impact at the end of the day. So it's getting that feedback about things that practices that people have changed, or yeah, things that they've spoken up about that previously they maybe wouldn't have spoken up about. And then you know that, yeah, those little pockets have changed. Because what I always say is, you know, so much went wrong in Michael's case that if just one or two things, if one or two people had raised their game in a particular way, then you plug those holes and it doesn't happen. So that's what we're trying to do. Plug holes all over the place.
It's so interesting to a point that if you look at kind of all these stories, so like, you know, Michael's and your story, and then you've got like Jason Anker, we had him on the podcast as well, and then I remember, I can't remember the name of the case, but I remember when I first started learning in my career in health and safety, covering a case study of a gentleman that had gone inside an industrial cooker. And unfortunately, same thing, you know, lockout, tagout would have solved that. Unfortunately, somebody turned the oven on. Long story short, we know what happened there.
One of his relatives, I think, that turned it on, wasn't it? I think.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's quite a popular story. It was like his father-in-law or future father-in-law. When you look at it and you look at all these things, and one of the things in Michael's story that I think stands out with me is it that important job, you know, this is the last minute job. We've got to get going. Pressure, you know, to just get the job done quickly. But yeah, so those kind of those pressures, I think, is so interesting, and to a point that it really does change how we work, doesn't it? It's how quick you always think, you know, we cut those corners because we need that job to go out now, and it's everywhere. I remember having that in manufacturing. This has got to happen. I remember we had, long story short, we were making a product that was going to go as installation, and it needed to be flame retardant as per legislation, which, you know, we kind of seeing a lot of that on the news now. But and I remember talking to the customer being like, this is not going out the door, mate. We were a quality as well, and we're like, this is not going out the door. And I remember the phrase, get it. I need it now. I don't care. Get it. And it's like, no. And that took, as a very young kind of person, very young in my career, it was really hard to kind of say, no, we were under a lot of pressure. And I think if we didn't get the backing from our internal management team, I wonder, would we have sent that out? I think a lot of businesses might have just turned a blind eye.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there needs to be a bit of a rethink about penalty clauses. These sort of financial penalty clauses, if it's not done by then you're hit with a certain amount of thousands of pounds worth of liquidated damages or whatever, because yeah, it drives the wrong behaviours. I mean, in Michael's case, the penalty clause I think was only about £15,000 for a 720 grand job, but still it drives the wrong behaviours. And I don't know what we do. I wish I did know what we do to get away from that.
It's difficult, isn't it? I remember we talked in a podcast a while ago with a colleague of mine and just said, well, what about just kind of spitballing ideas? What if we were to have every kind of timeline target? We just add 10 or 20% for safe practices or something like that. I don't know. But then I think about it, well, yeah, maybe that would work for the first year, and then we'll get used to it and we would just fill that 10% with whatever work and stuff like that, and you would just account for it. And I think that is one of the harder things, is you're really trying to change mindsets there of industries, not just like one or two person. You're trying to change the finance department, the quoting department, the sales department.
Yeah, absolutely, it's a question for another day. I think I don't have the answer to that one, sadly.
No. You're right. But I do think, like, it's interesting that we look at kind of the story and I think, you know, to a point, if we had all of those pressures, et cetera, you know, let's say we can't get rid of those. Like you say, it's conversation for a very long podcast, I suppose, that one. But it wouldn't matter, maybe, or it would matter less if everyone was still, as a given, doing lockout, tagout, you know, we had the right tools that were ergonomically correct to be able to put your thumb wherever you need to put it, and so on and so forth. We wouldn't probably need to focus on the pressure side of things so much, because the employees would just, that would be natural. You would just go, well, you've got to account 10 minutes per job for the lotto, for example. And that's a given. That's what we need, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, there's that, yeah, that safety net of, yeah, the safe environment that you're working in, I guess. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if it's that there needs to be sort of a reward for an employer putting their subcontractor, putting their hands up and saying, look, we can't do it safely in the time that we have left. That, you know, that people feel that they can have that adult conversation rather than plough on regardless.
Yeah.
Because if they had stopped and taken a step back on that night of the 4th of August, then they would have realised there was no way they were getting that job done anyway, regardless of the number of men they threw at it by the next again morning. So do you know what? It's a sports shop. It's a gym complex. It's going to open anyway. Like, seriously, is it worth what happened?
Yeah.
It's not.
It's not, is it? It's really not. And that's the horrible part of it. And it's the irony is that, you know, that place probably didn't open for a lot longer than what it would have because of Michael's case and everything.
Absolutely.
They couldn't do anything. So actually, you're going to bit themselves in the bum, really, haven't they? To for lack of a better phrase. I do think this stuff is so, you know, your story is obviously primarily around electrical safety, but those kind of fundamentals, they apply to so many other industries and so many things, you know, that let's get this job done. And I do a lot of work around fire safety, and probably dominates my role at the moment. You're currently kind of going around doing a lot of training, and I use this example of an escape room, because I say we would never design a building with no means of escape unless you're going to an escape room, which the whole unique selling point is that you're locked in the building, you've got to try and get your way out, which is ironic from a fire safety point of view. But I remember going to this one, and I use this example that there was no fire escape in this bit where we were, and the doors were locked with like typical padlocks that you would lock your shed up with. And I remember thinking, like, going in there and looking around. And I think if you're in this game, you do it naturally, you know, especially if you're kind of an auditor, risk assessor, you're trained to go in a room and look around, like up, down. So I just do it naturally all the time. So I look around, no detection. And I'm thinking, well, hello, we should probably have a lot of fire detection in a building like this. And I remember, like, my mates and my wife take the mick out of me, but I remember thinking, like, this place is dangerous. Like, I don't want to shut it down. I don't. I want us to be able to do things like this, but I want us to be able to do it as safe as possible.
Yeah.
And the fact is, there are very sophisticated systems that we could have had in that building that had a lot of detection. As soon as it goes off, bang, doors are open, lights are on, everything. We can have a good amount of supervision. And actually, we can get it done. But when we look back on it and we think, well, what were their priorities when they started building this place? How cheap can we get this up? And how quick can we get it up to make as much money as possible?
Yep.
And that's it. That's our priorities. And it's like, you know, without getting into a massive conversation about capitalism and all that crap, it's like, we need to just change our priorities. It's like, how can we do this as quick and as safe as possible?
Yeah.
And that's got to be the kind of driver, isn't it?
Yeah.
Again, we're talking about changing mindsets of a nation.
Yeah.
Or three nations, no. England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland. Yeah, four nations.
Yeah. It's a big old job of work right there. Yeah.
We must be seeing some, like you were saying, some positives coming out of what you're doing. Are you seeing a change? Are you satisfied with some of the stuff you're seeing, or are you not seeing anything?
No, I am seeing change. Like, I definitely see change in businesses that I go into. My biggest concern is kind of the electrical industry as a whole, and the fact that it seems to be run by the same people who've always run it, that there, I don't know, it seems like a bit of a, you know, boys network, that
jobs,
you know,
for boys kind of thing.
Yeah, if you don't have your job in that organization anymore, then it's fine because you can get your job in this organization. I think there just needs to be a bit of a shake-up, if I'm being honest. Particularly of the electrical contracting bodies. I would like that the electrical contracting bodies took more of a proactive role in auditing their members to see if they are implementing safe isolation procedures, for example. But what I understand is the case that, you know, there's not any sort of spot checks done, that it's much more of a planned, right, we'll be at your job in this place on such and such a day, you know, and we're coming to see your work. Well,
by the time the inspector's there, they're covered in PPE and everything's
Everything's hunky-dory. It's like, well, no, do you know what? Turn up at a job unannounced and see what really the lie of the land is. I would like to see that happening much more often. You know, the HSE, they've had their budget slashed. The likelihood of an organisation getting a proactive preventative inspection these days is way down. So there must be other ways to do it. That would be a big thing that I would like to see happen.
And I think, you know what, that would be in so many industries, these accrediting bodies that we have and these membership clubs and whatever that we have. You know, I've said for a long time, especially in the fire game, and it was funny that you said exactly the same thing. I call it club for boys, and I've said that for a while. Like, and you've got, and I'm not going to say what organisation, but you've got some out there that actually promote you, that we don't have to come to your site for you to give you this badge to say you're safe. And the irony of that is like, so hang on a minute, how are you assessing if I'm safe then as a contractor? It's just paperwork. Now, if we look back at your story, the employer had the RAMs, yeah, they had the risk assessments, the method statements, had the policies, etc. And actually, when you listen to your story and hear about all the stuff they talk about, lockout, tag out, testing for dead, etc., like, that's all spot on. So me as an employer of said contractor would be like, well, they've got the badge that says they're a safe contractor. They've got the RAMs because I've seen them. You know, they've got insurance. They've got all the stuff there. And us kind of as maybe customers employing these contractors that led into a false sense of security, really, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. No, there needs to be better ways, of checking things. As you say, you can have all the paperwork you want, but if you're not putting that paperwork into practice, it is utterly meaningless. Meaningless.
And I think if you combine that with what you were saying about kind of positive incentives, so like positive reinforcement, you know, if you had, so I don't know, McPherson accrediting body, for example, and we were to go out to Louise Electrical and then be like, oh, I can see you're using lockout tag out there, Louise. Why are you using that? Oh, because we've got two boys working on this system, blah, blah, blah. And then be like, great, you've got 10% off your next month's membership for safe practices. You know, I think if we combine stuff like that, it just makes it, it encourages people, like, you know, how can we save money? It's that safety person going in and saying, I've got a way we can save money. We can have it absolutely perfect. And our accrediting body, McPherson Accreditation, will knock 10% off of being a actual safe contractor or something like that.
I think the electrical contracting industry as a whole, it's a bit of a mystery to me, like, where safety comes in their priorities, if I'm being honest. Because even the awards that we were at last week, it's the Electrical Industry Awards, and I got told by Super Rod that, you know, they'd put in a submission about the campaign that we'd been running and that had been shortlisted for an award. And I was like, oh, brilliant, like a safety award for it would be amazing. And they were like, no, there's no safety award, it's a marketing initiative award. But there must be a safety category, surely, at the Electrical Industry Awards. No safety category. So yeah, even little things like that make you think, really, where are we, people, in having health and safety as the number one priority of the electrical contracting industry? We're still a long way off.
It is, isn't it? It's like, it's just, I think, just changing those perceptions, isn't it? Just yeah, I think we've got to, I think we've just got to pick those, that one thing that, you know, whether it's the accrediting bodies, the memberships, the suppliers, you know, even the customers, to be honest, you know, I mean, it's, let's say I was a customer employing an electrical contractor, it's doing that little bit more than just asking for the RAMs, you mm-hmm. know, and I think that's a good, to be honest, it's a good point to highlight that as a customer, you've got just as much responsibility for that contractor as they have for their employees.
Yeah, yeah, and Mace, that I did some work with recently, they had a bit of a focus on electrical safety, and what they had done was, because, I mean, they're using subcontractors and in some cases sub-subcontractors maybe doing electrical work, what they had done was put through all their health and safety professionals through a safe isolation course.
Okay.
So that the safety professionals actually understood what it was they were looking for. So if they were going around and auditing or doing a safety walk round or whatever it might be, that actually they could clock if something wasn't right. So I think that would be a great thing for the sort of the customer, the principal contractor, whatever, to be doing to improve conditions on sites.
Yeah, it is just so much to kind of look at, isn't it? I mean, you touch on like about like the supervision as well, and and I think you touch on in kind of your full story about the supervisor not thinking that safety was part of his job, which is fascinating. And again, it's frustrating that we hear that all the time. You know, I hear that all the time. And even now, like in 2019, for God's sake, and I still get, you know, emails being like, you know, safety, that's your job because you've got safety in your title.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's not my job. I'm here to help you, guide you, coach you, train you, whatever you want.
Yeah.
I'll give you it. But it's your job. It's not even a job. It's something you should just have there all the time. It shouldn't even be a priority. It's just there in your head all the time thinking, and what am I doing? Could that hurt me or hurt someone else?
Yeah.
I think Jason Anker's story quite heavily focuses originally anyway on that kind of, you're doing this to protect yourself, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Like not just, you know, lockout, tagout is a great example. Testing for dead is a great example. You're the one working on that system, not anyone else.
Yeah. And I mean, in Michael's case, the supervisor, yeah, you're right. He said, I don't regard it as part of my job to ensure that safe working practices are adhered to at all times. And he said that the procedures in the contract safety plan were not enforced by me. Now, he was a non-working charge hand, was his title. So if you're a non-working charge hand, if you're not actually doing the work, you're overseeing the work, what is it you're looking for if you don't think that safety is part of that role? It's just a bit of a mystery. The fact is, I also think there was an issue with his training. So the way he had been trained. He's one of these individuals who's kind of come up through the ranks and he's got the years of experience, and then you just get promoted, don't you?
Yeah.
Without actually the training behind that to tell you what your role is meant to be. So I think there was an element of that in Michael's case as well.
I think that's a good point, because I remember when you were saying about that, I remember, it's annoying that all of my examples are primarily fire-based, but when I was in manufacturing, we would do regular evacuation drills, for example. We had quite a high explosive environment, so it was very important that we could evacuate this building as quick as possible, because if something went up, it was going up. Well, anyway, long story short, we did a drill and we were just observing, because we had like a high platform. So me and the manager of this area were just observing kind of what would go on, kind of from a bird's eye point of view. We were really lucky to have that.
Mm-hmm.
So we just stood there, the alarm went off. The apprentice, spot on, did everything he needed to do, turned the machine off he goes out of the building. As he was making his way out of the building, the machine operator who was training said apprentice with two coffees in his hand, "So what are you doing?" He said, "The alarm's going off. Just turn the machine off. We got to go." And he went, No. The roller shutters haven't come down. That means not a real fire. Come on, get back to your machine. When did you turn the machine off? About 30 seconds ago. Quick, turn it back on before we lose the product. And it was like, and me and I remember, oh, I nearly said his name then, but me and the manager standing there and just with our mouths open, like in shock.
Wow.
But what it did do, luckily, was highlight that it's not the alarms that are telling these people, it's right. the roller shutters. So we left it about 6 months. We did a bit of training and then we left it 6 months, didn't say anything. We didn't mention it. We did nothing. And then we did another drill and we didn't turn the roller shutters off. We let them come down. Pandemonium. Everybody panicked. They literally thought the place was going to explode.
Right.
And that was really eye-opening to us. But it's interesting to your point that that apprentice was only being trained. You know, it was only a machine apprenticeship. So he didn't really go to college or do anything. He was getting everything taught by us.
Okay.
And we were teaching him wrong.
Right.
So it started from day dot.
Okay.
Those bad habits.
But it's that kind of sort of the regularity of things and people getting to know those sorts of things, like that. Yeah, you know, the shutters aren't coming down, so it's fine. There's also the supervision point there that, you know, I did a safety walk round recently and we caught a couple of guys. I say caught, but we came across a couple of guys who were doing something in a way that they really shouldn't have been doing it.
Okay.
So, you know, we enticed them down from the height that they were at and have a chat with them and say, you know, should you really be doing it that way? And, you know, where's your supervisor? What does your supervisor say about you doing it this way? And we won't see the supervisor again until like 3:30.
Mm.
How do you know that? Oh, because that's when he does. That's when he comes round. Like, he does his walk round at 3:30. All right. Okay. So you know that you can get away with stuff because he's not going to be round again until 3:30. So yeah, mix it up a bit, people.
It's true, and it is hard. It's hard to a point that, you know, like you said court, and I know you corrected yourself, and then the phrase supervisor as well. It puts us in this position where we kind of are saying that these people are not intelligent enough to manage their own safety, but we're not seeing it, are we? We're not seeing people managing their own safety sometimes, and that is again, it's a quite of a big part of Jason's story. Is like, he was very much talks about how I could have changed my future.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was lucky to live. Obviously with some serious disabilities, but it's that two-pronged approach, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the supervisor in my brother's case said that, you know, they were all experienced guys. I shouldn't have had to look over their shoulders constantly. And absolutely, you shouldn't have had to look over their shoulders constantly. But I kind of use the analogy of speeding cameras. So you've got a stationary speed camera up ahead. If you've been speeding, you slow down until such time as you're past that stationary speed camera and you're going to speed back up again, because that's it, it's bye. That's your kind of supervisor who kind of drops in every now and again. Whereas if you've got the average speed cameras, then you're much more likely to stick to that speed limit. But it's not one person, it's a number of people.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not about that one supervisor, it's about everyone looking out for one another and being able to stop their colleague if they think that their colleague's not quite about to do something right, or to speak up themselves and say, I'm not doing it, you can't put me to work in that way. So yeah, it's not about that one supervisor.
No.
It's about a bit of a regularity of supervision.
As well, maybe at the point that you, for lack of a better word, you catch someone doing something dangerous, so from my point of view anyway, I think that is a key moment. You spot somebody doing something, you know, I don't know, working on a live circuit, you know, standing on the top rung of a ladder, whatever, and you just say, whoa, hang on a minute, mate, jump down. And it's that you, safety professionals especially, need to, I think, come away from that finger pointing, you're doing this wrong, blah blah blah, and highlight this as an opportunity to educate, to learn. This is a learning opportunity to get someone down and be like, mate, I just noticed you're on the top rung, do you know why you're not really supposed to stand on the top rung, and explain that. Do you know, actually, if you're working on a live circuit, yeah, you know, I don't want to state the obvious, but that's really dangerous. And you go, why? Well, yeah, obviously I do, but everybody, you know, does it like that, blah blah blah. And then you'd be like, do you know what lockout tagout is? And stuff like, no, I never heard of it. Okay, let's go and let's go and do that and treat it like that. So yes, we can say supervise, yes, we can say court, but it's how we approach those situations afterwards, I think, that make the difference.
Absolutely. About being able to have that sort of safety coaching conversation. And I'm guilty of it myself, getting it wrong in instances where I see somebody doing something wrong. Mm. And I did it myself just a couple of weeks ago with a couple of scaffolders I saw climbing up stuff that there was a sheer drop below them, not harnessed on, and I challenged them in a way that I shouldn't have challenged them. But I got myself caught up in that moment of, how could you be so stupid? What you're doing? How could you put yourself at risk in that way? Just shortly after that, I was at a company. I was at Twinings, actually, in Andover, and I was doing a piece with their health and safety manager, who was also talking about coaching conversations.
It really
ticked me. I know that in future I'm going to approach those types of conversations much differently to the way that I approached that one.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story that is, like, and the fact that you could acknowledge that actually you didn't get the result maybe that you wanted, even though what you're doing is amazing. But in that second, and we actually talked about it, I did a podcast, I think it was like two podcasts ago, about the language that we talk about. And I use the example of Greta Thunberg, I can't pronounce her second name, the young girl that's doing all the environmental work, doing a fascinating job, you know, getting a message out there that's unbelievable. You know, I'm a massive advocate of her. However, you look at the amount of hate that she's getting online, and then you compare that to the language that she uses, which is a very aggressive language of your generation is killing my generation and you doing this wrong. And it's very much an aggressive mannerisms and language attacking specific generations. So those people that are being targeted by her speech, be it whether she's right or wrong, doesn't matter. They've stopped listening. They don't care. They're looking at Greta now going, you're just an ungrateful little bitch, and just completely switched off. And they're not now. You've lost that opportunity to educate. You've lost that opportunity to say,
engage them positively.
Exactly. And it's so true. And it kind of brings me to another example of my very, very good friend of mine, best friend of mine, was my best man. And I talk about him a lot in this podcast because he is literally your kind of stereotypical builder, you know, and he just doesn't get safety whatsoever. But over the years, and I'm kind of chipping away at him, and he's starting to open his eyes a little bit. And he has a great story of the safety guy coming over, very aggressive, very hierarchical, you're doing this wrong. If he'd have known my best mate, I tell you now, you ain't going to get anywhere if you talk to him like that. He's stubborn as a mule, switch off, gone. You've got to approach these people sometimes in a manner in which, you know, you might not get to address what you want to address in that conversation, but it's the next conversation where they like you and they know you. Oh, all right, James, how you doing? And you go back and you'd be like, let's just have a chat about ladders or whatever. Right. You know what I mean? But it's hard. And I imagine it's so, so hard for you when there's such an emotional connection to it. It must be a real challenge.
It is a real challenge, just reining that in a bit. There's no point in coming over as the over-emotional female who's having a rant at them about whether their parents would enjoy kind of arranging their funeral. It's not the best way to go about it, Louise, really. So,
but it's understanding. I can completely understand why you would have that kind of approach. That must have been and that's a recent transition you're going through now. Or do you find that that's something you've struggled with for a while?
I think I've adopted the wrong approach in the past. I will now do it a different way, having listened to that chat at Twinings.
Well, amazing kind of, it's an amazing story, but it's also fascinating to see kind of your story within that story of Michael's story, and your kind of transition as well is fascinating. I could probably talk to you for hours about this, but probably shouldn't. You've got a life, and I've got a little
a
bit
dog.
Of a life. My dog's just started barking again. And so if you want to kind of talk us about, you do a lot of work with you've obviously mentioned families against corporate killers, and you do some, just double making sure I get the names right, get my notes, with Scottish Hazards. You mentioned that earlier, I think, but maybe just give us a bit of an introduction, especially for anyone who's up your way, as to what those organizations can do or are doing for people, and kind of how we could utilize those organizations as well.
Yeah, so Scottish Hazards, it's been a campaigning organisation for about 20 years, and perhaps about 4 or 5 years ago now, I was asked to take on a job to convert it to charitable status, because what they had always wanted to do was open an advice centre for workers on health and safety issues.
Yeah.
So they'd never really had the money, but then got given a bit of seed money, and they thought, if we don't do this now, we're never ever going to do it. So yeah. It was just at the time that I'd started telling Michael's story. So I then took on that role. We converted it to charitable status, and we then launched the Advice Centre for workers. So it's primarily aimed at non-unionised workplaces, because they're the people who are most likely to not have the sort of ready access to health and safety advice or training. Mm. We have a helpline number, which is 0800 0015 022, and what we want to do is get to situations before they result in the injury or the illness worse. So, whatever sector, whatever work environment people are working in, whether it's that they have concerns that, they've been set to work somewhere where asbestos is present and it's not being managed correctly, we can deal with that. Whether it's, we've had calls from, chefs who've not been given the right overalls to wear, other individuals who haven't been given the right safety equipment for working at height. Lots of different things. But if an individual has a concern and they're thinking there's an accident waiting to happen here, we want to hear from them. But also if there's a relative of somebody who's going home of a night and saying to their loved one, see my workplace, you never guess what's happened today.
Yeah.
If that relative has a concern about their loved one, we want that relative to phone us as well if we can help, because I get it. People have a job, they don't want to be rocking the boat or whatever else. They maybe don't want to make the call themselves, but if we can somehow assist and make things better, then that's what we want to do.
That's a good idea, actually. Kind of not targeting is not the right word, but offering that kind of channel of communication from that other source. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
And I'll put all the links and stuff in the description to the websites and that, so that anyone that's listening to this can go on. And I'll put your website on there as well. There's quite a lot of, you've got just the full story on your website as well, haven't you? So people can go and watch the videos that you've done.
Yeah, there's a sort of 6-minute video that would give an overview of what happened to Michael. Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks, James.
No problem. Thank you for coming on the podcast, and thank you for doing everything that you're doing. I think we need more and more people just kind of communicating those stories. It's horrible that we need those stories for us to listen, but it's amazing that people like yourself and Jason's got a whole team of people that are doing stuff like this. It's such a shame that they've got to go through those painful events to do it. But from my point of view, it only helps me as a professional to be able to communicate the moral side of things, and to be able to use your stories to actually get people to listen to me, which is, so thank you is probably the only thing I would like to say.
Thank you back to you as well, because I'm one person, so it needs other people to be taking the message and getting it out to other people. So thank 100%. You.
Okay, guys, I hope you found that conversation interesting, useful. You can really hear that it's difficult for Louise to say even now, after the years that she's been doing this day in, day out. I can only thank Louise and people like Louise, like Jason and Abby and their team at Proud to Be Safe, and all other people out there that have taken their horrible incidents in their lives and turned it into a positive to help us safety professionals and businesses have our eyes opened and to really kind of see that this stuff does actually go wrong, and when it does, it can have harrowing effects. So thanks again, Louise, and thank you everyone out there that's helping health safety professionals and etc. do their jobs as safe as possible by making it real for us. And I'm sorry that you had to go through that stuff for us to hear these stories, but thank you. Don't forget to check out Louise's story. We're going to link everything down in the description. We'll link all of the kind of organisations that she's helping out as well. Don't forget to try and get yourself to one of these expos or something that Louise does. She travels all around the country talking, so just keep your eye out for her name. And definitely go check her out. It is a heart-rending story when you hear the whole thing. And yeah, you know, I won't lie, I had a tear rolling down my cheek when I heard it the first time in public. But have a think, peeps, you know, especially if you're in electrical industry, you know, have a think. Are you doing those things, or are your employees doing those things, or are your mates doing those things? You know, you have an obligation to just question it and challenge it. You know, we can demand better from industries, and you know, an industry is not going to provide pliers that are more ergonomically fitted to you to allow you to put your thumb over the grip unless you demand change. I think there is a real power in us, so I'll leave it there. I hope you found this useful. Don't forget to hit subscribe. If you're on YouTube, don't forget to hit the bell as well. Have a think. Are there three people that you can think of right now that will benefit from this podcast? If there is, share it with them. Let them hear this story. Think of three people that you know right now that will benefit from this story and share it with them. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to give us a rate or a review on iTunes, any of the other podcast platforms. And if you do leave us a review, you know, screenshot it and tweet us at Rebranded Safety, or come find us on Facebook, Rebranded Safety. Even come find me on LinkedIn. All the links are in the description below. I'll catch you in the next podcast, guys. Safe.